Morning, you. Welcome back to Uncensored. I'm Mariam, your host, friend, Yas Mermaid. And I am truly honored to have John Leonida on the other side of the screen. He's a recently retired super yacht lawyer. He is a PhD researcher on the super yacht history. And he's also a Fowler design judge. Thank you so much, John, for saying yes to coming to the show. Yeah, I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and it's strange to hear those words, retired super yacht lawyer, but it is true.
I don't know if that is the reason why you were able to say yes to coming to the show, because it seems like a lot of lawyers, for whatever, I don't know, legal reason, they are not able to come to the show and just speak freely, right, and give their opinions and their wisdom. So if you retiring has allowed me to have you on the show, I said, hell yes. Thank you for retiring.
Those who know me, and there are one or two people who know who I am, in my 23 years of being involved in the super yacht industry, I've never been shy at expressing my opinions, usually quite controversially, but it is an important part of everyone involved in the industry to talk about what goes on in order to change it. And the industry that I joined 23 years ago, it is a very different industry to the industry that it is today. A lot of the same issues are still there, but we've highlighted them, and things that were not talked about 20 years ago are spoken about today, and today often spoken about in terms that make those activities unacceptable.
Absolutely. And this is the main reason why I really wanted to have this conversation with you and share this with the community, because we need to understand why. So we see a lot of changes happening in the industry, technology-wise, and I don't know, a few things here and there, but it feels like it's all like a band-aid. Like when you look at the industry, a lot of the, I'm talking human rights, really. This is what I'm talking about. They haven't changed. They haven't transformed. I really want to tap into your wisdom. And because you have that, you have done so much research about the history of superyacht, because a lot of people don't even know the history of superyacht, including myself. I'm learning now through you, and because you sparked my curiosity on it. And I realized, like you said, it's the foundation hasn't changed. And this is why we see the same issues over and over. And I was so amazed when you told me, close your eyes in one of our conversations, and you read like a letter or an article. And you said, when do you think this was written? I was like, I don't know, maybe like yesterday. And you were like, 1920. I was like, what? So it really made me realize that nothing has changed. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Things do change, but the same experiences come up time and time again. And what's been fascinating for me in commencing my research for my thesis, which looks at the social and cultural influence of super yachts in the last 100 years, is that there has been a super yacht industry to speak of in the last 100 years. And if truth be told, there was a super yacht industry going back to the early 19th century. In fact, in 1852, Cornelius Vanderbilt built an 85-meter steam yacht in New York and set sail from Sandy Hook and went to the Le Vivant and returned. And it was a yacht that all of us would recognize in terms of its luxury, its appointment. In fact, one of the newspapers at the time wrote that when the yacht would arrive in Europe, the aristocrats and the kings of Europe would recognize that there was essentially a new king in town, Cornelius Vanderbilt. It was such a statement. We look at that in 1852, an 85-meter yacht in 1852, and we look at some of the 85-meter yachts of today, and essentially they try and do the same thing. So this is 150 years later, if not 170 years later. What is new? In essence, things are new, but essentially nothing is new. And what's been interesting for me in, for example, there's a book I have on my desk here, which I found fascinating. I don't know if you can see that.
Yeah.
It's called 60 Years of Yachts, and it's written by Herbert Julian. Now, Herbert Julian was a yacht broker who started working as a yacht broker in 1890, just behind Piccadilly Circus in London. And he tells these stories of yacht brokerage and the activities on board the yacht, which, if you change the title of the book, and it was written by one of the modern yacht brokers, and you set it today, you would not question the detail of the book. He tells stories of brokers complaining to other brokers that they have stolen each other's clients. He tells stories about the sort of bad behavior on board yacht by crew and by guests and owners, which are issues which are still happening today. So what's been fascinating in my early research is just, as you say, how often history repeats itself. As someone once said, that when history repeats itself once, it's fast. When it repeats itself twice, it's a tragedy. In our case, it's probably repeated itself 6, 7, or 8 times. So I don't know what kind of tragedy that would be.
I mean, we're living in it. And I'm hoping that tragedy is really bringing on enough awareness to create the transformation that's being called for. But one of the things that, as you're talking, came to mind is that previously to start recording, we were talking about how you as a lawyer always advise your clients about, you were telling me how a yacht is like a real estate just on the sea, like a floating real estate, and how lots don't change just because you're floating, right? It's like the same way, because many of these yacht owners, they have hotels, they have villas, they have estates, they have other houses in that sense, and businesses. And it's really interesting how you said to them, the same way you would treat your employees in your hotel, that is the same way you should treat your crew. It doesn't change yet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this comes around when you look at the culture that surrounds our industry. And it comes down to a cultural, what is culturally acceptable on a yacht and what is culturally acceptable on land. Now, over my career, I've met many owners who are, as you say, have significant businesses ashore. And they are good employers. They will comply with the laws. They will pay their people appropriately. They will have HR departments. They will do everything that a good employer does ashore. However, there is a disconnect, almost a mental disconnect, the moment you get on board a yacht. There is an idea that runs through the yacht industry that yachts are fun, and that if you regulate anything, it takes away the fun. I remember sitting in a conference hall several years ago when we were talking about the introduction of MLC, and it hadn't been yet introduced, but it was about to be introduced. And fairly senior figures within the industry stood up and said, MLC should not apply to yachts are fun. Why should crew have all these employment rights? This is my holiday home. And these were very senior figures within the superyacht industry. And in fact, in my career, every major
people... I interrupt you.
Sorry, go ahead.
People like owners, managers, brokers, builders?
All of the above.
Okay.
All of the above. And flag states as well. And at each point in my career, there have been new pieces of legislation which have affected the industry, whether it's matters relating to security, ISM, MLC, the various iterations of the large yacht code. And at each turn, there has been resistance within the industry to apply those bits of legislation, saying, oh, this will kill the industry. We shouldn't have these laws. But let us take a step back for a moment and think, what are we dealing with? A yacht is a ship. The fact that it is painted white and it has cinema rooms and jacuzzis and spas on board, it is a ship. The regulations that apply to oil tankers or anchor handlers or container ships pretty much apply to yachts. They've been slightly modified because of the design and the use of the yacht. But the DNA of international maritime law applies to every ship that sails upon the seas. It is no different. And to own a yacht means to own a ship. And there is a responsibility that comes with that. And yes, the industry that we work in is glamorous. It's fun. It's sexy. It is at the leading edge of design, of technology. But it is still a business that deals with ships. And but if you have...
Sorry, it seems you talk about the DNA, right? And it's okay, yeah, it is a ship. And a lot of the things, or I wouldn't say a lot, but the DNA, like you call it, is the same across the border. Yet, I would say it's the microbiome DNA of the maritime industry that is the one that crosses around, which is like a 10%. And then the 90%, which is like what we really call the DNA of a yacht, for some reason, I'm assuming this is like the people, obviously, that we were talking about, brokers, owners, flag states, all these people created the loopholes in order for their fawn not to be killed, in order for them to step on the boat. And for some reason, like you said, some sort of emotional, mental disconnection, think, you know what? Fornicating in front of my crew, it's okay, because I'm on my holiday house. You know what I mean? They don't do this in their hotels and businesses.
Of course not.
It's okay to do it on board. It's cool. Why? I'm a human. I don't want to see your dick. You know what I mean? Like, why do you believe that you have the right to do this? I don't
know. The
law doesn't really comply to really helping human rights on board a yacht because it's a private pleasure vessel.
But it is a place of work.
Exactly.
The crew members are employees of a company that own a yacht. I saw a photograph in the last week of, and it's been suggested to me that it is a yacht captain who is standing on the bulbous bow of the yacht with his back to the camera, but naked. And that's appeared on social media. Now, if that was not a captain, and let's say that is the chief executive of a business, he stands outside his office naked. How long would he still be chief executive of that business?
Exactly.
He wouldn't last 5 minutes. Yet, we think that kind of behavior is acceptable in the industry.
And what do you think that is?
Because there is a culture that comes from those who have developed the industry. It is an industry that is very Anglo-Saxon, that is dominated by the Brits, and there is very much a culture that comes from the private clubs, the culture that comes from a naval tradition, which has been frozen in aspic. A lot of the behaviors and attitudes that exist on board yachts no longer exist ashore. And it used to exist within the commercial fleet as well. And it no longer exists in the commercial fleet. In a sense, the yachts are the last bastion of that kind of behavior where the captain is the master of all he surveys. Now, in the commercial fleet, the captains have been reduced to just driving the ships from A to B. All real management, all real control, all real decision making has come ashore to the ship management divisions of commercial shipping organization, which prevents that kind of behavior happening. Now, it doesn't mean within the commercial world that crew are not mistreated, which is why there is some move to to have a some kind of declaration of human rights for at sea to cover those crew, because we've seen during the COVID period crew being abandoned in ports far from the home and not being flown back to their homes. We've seen situations where crew have been abandoned on board ships without proper medical provision, without proper food. We've seen situations where crew are, within the commercial fleet, mistreated on board. And no one seems to be answerable for that mistreatment. In a sense, yes, on the very best ships, people behave very well. But there are smaller ships on flags of convenience where crews can get mistreated, and they shouldn't be. And there are instances on yachts, and it's not all yachts. That's not over-egging. But even to the extent that it does exist on yachts, it shouldn't exist on yachts. And that requires a culture change. And it requires a culture change where people accept that yachts are not the private preserve of the captain and the senior officers of the yacht, that they are professional individuals who have a responsibility to represent the owning company and have a responsibility to treat all their crew with dignity, with equanimity, and indeed with a degree of respect. And at the moment, there is nothing culturally that forces that upon yacht owners and by extension, yacht captains. So we rely on individual yacht captains who have a sense of fair play to do the right thing. And the vast majority do. But there are too many instances, as have been highlighted in the last few weeks on your interviews and in on social media, where that clearly is not the case.
Literally yesterday, I got a call from a captain and he said to me, why are you stirring the pot? Why are you creating so much commotion on things that, let's just have fun. Don't make it such a big deal. And I said, you know what? Your rights, my rights are your rights. So what I do for me, I'm actually doing for you. And second, I believe, yes, you were a really cool captain because you let me do whatever the fuck I wanted on board. And to be honest, that is wrong. Because on the vessel that I was with him, we weren't even fed basic stuff that we are meant to have as part of the situation that we're in, weren't even being met because, oh, why bother? Let's just keep having fun. They're not bothering us. We can do this. We can do that. But that comes with a cost. And I think, yeah, there's a lot of people out there that are going to look at this and they're going to be like, holy shit, why? Like, this is working out. I said, actually, it's not, because everything is okay until something happens to you. And when something happens to you, that's when you start thinking, wow, why didn't I look at this? Why aren't these regulations implemented, you know? And I feel that one of the things that you have said to me is that, are we on a crossroad? Are we on that threshold of really shifting finally? Because like you said, the yachting industry is almost like the last man standing, you know, and they're holding on tight to this. They're holding on tight. There's a lot of resistance.
Well, I think the conversation I've been having with a lot of people in the last 6 months during the lockdown, and there's been a lot of reflection, if you will. And in a sense, this is what precipitated my thoughts on the thesis. In 2008, when we had the economic crisis, and I can't believe it is 12 years since that happened, and we still talk about it in the way that people still talk about 1929 and the Great Depression. People started saying, how do we get people engaged with yachting? And the original reaction, and still the reaction, is let's find the next big pot of money that can sustain the industry. Let's tell people how fabulous the industry is. let's tell people how many people the yacht industry employs. What people didn't do is look inwards and say 95% of qualified individuals don't want to buy yachts. Why don't they want to buy yachts? As opposed to us telling them yachts are fab. And it's looking at the barriers to entry. Going back to my days as an economist, we always spoke about barriers to entry into a market. What barriers have we, as a superyacht industry, erected, which when people see that, people say, actually, I don't want anything to do with that. There are a range of, now, traditional barriers of entry are to do with businesses trying to keep people out. But are our cultural behaviors making yachts unattractive to potential buyers? Now, I was watching on Netflix the other night. There's a French film that the English title is An Easy Girl, which won in 2019 at the Cannes Film Festival the best French feature. It was directed by Rebecca Zelowski. And it features a yacht owner who has a Sunseeker and his relationship to a local girl who is showered with handbags and gifts, etc., of the type that we're well familiar with.
Yeah.
And it paints a picture of yacht owners, which, if you don't know the yacht industry, is not a very attractive one. But there are all the cultural references, whether it's social media, whether it's programs like that Sky TV did, Riviera, the Below Decks reality series. All of those cultural references to yachts, which potential yacht owners will see, doesn't draw people into the industry. And the reason that those programs, those films can be made, because they draw on reality. They're not fictional. Everything that I saw in that film, I've heard about, I've seen. Everything that you see in that TV series Riviera, I've seen. When I started my research, I was reading about a yacht previously owned by the Duke of Westminster in the 1930s. And the Duke of Westminster sold it to a man in his 60s who left his wife and took up with a young girl in her mid-20s. And the newspapers in the 1930s were writing about the kind of bad behavior that this young girl and her friends were getting up to on the yacht that was previously owned by the Duke of Westminster. So culturally, those things have always been there. The difference being, in 2020, the media channels are so loud, are so prevalent, are so 24/7, so 365, that the tiniest mistake is amplified larger than you could ever imagine. When you had the Panama Papers published a few years ago, then subsequently you had the scandal with one MBD, if I remember, with the arrest of the yacht Equanimity. You had, for example, Oxfam. When they had their Twitter feed and they were talking about the Panama Papers, they would print or publish photographs of yachts associating money laundering, tax evasion with the ownership of yachts. When you had the huge scandal of the defrauding of the Malaysian sovereign fund, all sorts of money was spent in all sorts of places. But the tangible thing that the newspapers focused on was the yacht Equanimity. That kind of cultural message, that cultural signature of illegal activity, bad behavior, is writ very strongly in the psychology of the general public, such that When I meet people and they say, what do you do? I'm involved in yachts, from outside our industry. All those tropes, all those stereotypes about yachting come out immediately. And it doesn't matter whether I'm meeting someone who is a bank clerk or a restaurateur or a billionaire. If you have no other connection with the super yacht world, that is your view of the super yacht world. And unless we change culturally, people won't want to engage with us. And that's, I think, the sad reality.
So how, and I understand everything you're saying, but that stereotype somehow, it just really seems to be the one that's heightened. Like, it's not that it's just like a stereotype that is minimal. And then so all of a sudden social media is just heightening it. It's like heightening something that's already heightened within the industry, right? I'm not saying something else doesn't exist. I'm just saying that the reality of things is that type of stereotype, it is the one that is more prevalent in our industry, sadly. But I think it is moving, we're moving away from it, especially with younger owners coming with a different mindset, really wanting to explore the world and not just sitting in Saint-Tropez, look at me kind of thing. You know, just having people with money that wants to invest in the industry with a different mindset, obviously that's going to be the part of the key of moving away from this stereotype of that we're basically drowning in.
Let's have a, not a history lesson per se, but the current iteration of the superyacht industry started roughly in the mid-1990s. As I said, the superyacht industry has been around for many years, but the current iteration of the superyacht industry, and there was this perfect storm of the internet boom, of the dot-com millionaires, the hedge fund money, the collapse of the USSR, and the influx of money from the former Soviet Union that propelled the growth of the superyacht industry. Now, it grew at such a rate that, and at such speed, that all the normal checks and balances that an industry that would build into itself as it matured just didn't happen. So when you look at the history of the car industry or the aviation industry in its early years, it suffered from the same kind of bad behaviors that we speak about. But this current iteration of the industry grew so fast that people were so focused on making money, and they made a lot of money. The number of deals that certainly I was involved in those early years, and people were buying yachts, flipping them, commissioning many yachts and selling them before they were delivered and making huge amounts of money, whether it's in the sale of the yacht or the commissions that were earned, the salaries that were paid. It was like the Wild West. It was a party that we thought would never end. But no one ever stopped to say, are we doing it the right way? And why would they? Because everyone was, it was one big champagne party. I mean, it was diamonds, it was champagne, it was cigars, it was everything to excess. And no one stopped to think, is this the right way forward? Now, I think the conversation that we're having is helping people reassess. I'm aware, and I can't talk about it publicly, that a number of senior players in the industry are actively re-examining how they portray themselves, re-examining issues of diversity, re-examining issues of behavior on board, in order to, because they recognize, I think, that an industry that does not engage with what's going on with society generally is an industry that will eventually not die completely, but it will shrink such that it's a shadow of our current self.
No, I totally agree. So moving forward, because I keep hearing a lot of from you where other industries, the aviation, even the more commercial side of ships, they have all been where we are in a sense, especially when it comes down to human rights and behaviors and all this stuff. And somehow, maybe not completely, but they have definitely starting to move away from that and towards something more sustainable, right? Because right now, this is not the way we're doing it. It's just not sustainable. It's like no. It's an excess, right? And if you push, it will fall, right?
I totally agree.
And it feels like we're like going down into that downhill almost. How can we move forward from this from different perspectives, from me being a crew member and you as a lawyer, people from builders, management, brokers, owners? There's a lot of characters involved in the evolution of this, right? And also moving forward, but especially with when it comes down to the law, but you said that even the flag states were like against a lot of this potential laws and regulations because they're like, oh no, we don't want to deal with that. We don't want to take the fun out of it. But the biggest thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I see is that in the yachting industry, there's nobody holding accountable anybody. Nobody's being held accountable, whether it's by a flag state, whether it's by a court, whether it's by the captain, management, brokers, like whoever. It just doesn't seem to be that accountability doesn't seem to be there. So for that reason, it's almost like I can get away with murder. Well,
there has always been this idea that if I can get away with it, I will do it. And I've always said to people, just because you get away with it doesn't make it right. And sorry about that. In the early part of the century, there was a lot of super yacht tax evasion. Some of it deliberate, some of it ill-advised, some of it by accident. And people were doing things which were frankly illegal, but they got away with it. And they got away with it because super yachts were not on the radar of the customs authorities. But the moment the super yachts came on the radar, tax became a big issue. And I was listening to my very good friend Nick Arnold from PwC quite recently in an interview in another place say that in recent years, owners have moved from listening to people who were peddling them this tax scheme or that tax scheme to owners saying, you know what? I need to do the right thing. I need to address tax properly and legally. I did an interview with, joint interview with Helen Brocklebank of Walpole, who promotes luxury goods here in the UK. And she said, and quite pointedly said, in future, luxury will include being socially responsible. Having the ability and the power to be socially responsible when you do not have to be, that will become potentially the greatest luxury. Treating all your employees correctly, paying your taxes, you being socially responsible, whether it's in respect of gender diversity, whether it's in respect of racial diversity, doing that because you choose to do it, yeah, will become, in a sense, a matter of luxury. And I think in many ways, Helen is absolutely right. I think a lot of owners that I've dealt with in recent years have said to me that they don't want the headache of being accused of tax evasion or tax avoidance. I have the money to pay my tax. I will pay my tax. Similarly, I've had situations where owners have dismissed crew on board who have behaved badly because of the administrative nightmare that it causes to have someone behave badly and having to deal with the fallout. I think the going forward, if we ourselves, yacht brokers, yacht managers, yacht builders, come from a position of saying, ethically, this is how we should behave, and we will not tolerate poor behavior, we will move to an industry which is culturally acceptable to broader society. Because when, for example, when people see a grand stately home or a Ferrari, people do not, as a knee-jerk reaction, think, what a waste of money. That's an excessive spend of cash. They admire the beauty of the Ferrari, the engineering. They admire the artistry, the artisans that went to build the grand stately home. There is a reverence which we do not have in the superyacht world. Superyachts should be the floating stately homes of the sea. Sadly, at the moment, we don't have that reverence towards them, but we can get there.
Absolutely. I think the fact that we're having this conversation is definitely a statement that this is happening, you know, it's a validation that this is where we're moving towards. Yeah, I think there's a lot, obviously, to this conversation. We can go on forever. I do have one more question before we wrap it up. Because law, maritime law, it's so gray and a little bit wishy-washy on my perspective and so hard to understand. And the more you look into it, the more confused you become because there's so many loopholes in it. And you're like, what? And this can be very, very confusing, especially for crew members, not so much for maybe owners and builders and all that because they have legal advice that they're paying for and all that. But it seems that legal advice for crew it's almost like non-existent in a way. You really have to dig for it and find it and obviously pay for it. We talk about something like the Maritime Law Convention, and that is what it is. It's just a bunch of people coming together, dictating what they believe the rules should be, right? So how do we, like, as a crew member, if you're in land, you know where to go. You have to go to the government, right? There's a building. You can go there. You can strike. You can do your thing until you're hurt, right? But it seems like, where do we do this on boats?
Well,
how does this actually change? Crew members, how can we be heard? How can our voices actually be heard?
I'm going to say something which will be an anathema to everyone in the industry. There are trade unions. There are maritime trade unions that have tried to organize. They are very well organized in the commercial fleet, almost non-existent within the superyacht fleet. And there are trade unions that you will take your union fee and you will provide the kind of advice that you need. If you have problems with your employer, unionizing crew is potentially one way forward. And you don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that they'll all be going on strike because that's the way unions are often portrayed. But unions are often a very good source of information and support if there is a problem with a particular owner or another person on board. The thing with most yacht crew, they all have their employment contract and the employer may be technically a BVI company. And people think, I'll have to go to the BVI for my problem. Not necessarily true. For example, and I've seen this happen many times, if your yacht is almost permanently berthed in France, for example. If you have enough connection with France, if you have an apartment ashore, if your kids go to school in France, the French courts will seize jurisdiction if you have a problem with a yacht owner. And I've seen that happen many times. Even if the contract doesn't mention law and jurisdiction, the French courts, and I believe the UK courts, if the yacht is berthed here, they will look at where is the closest connection to the actual job, not where the yacht is registered or where the yacht managers are. But if you are in Nice Harbor for most of the year, I've seen it happen time and time again. They employ, crew members have employed French lawyers, and the French lawyers have taken the yacht owners to court, and you often have won cases, sometimes lost, but often. But the important thing is that the French courts have seized jurisdiction. So there are things that can be done. Don't feel that because you're a crew member on a Cayman Island flag vessel that you've got no rights. Your rights actually come from the place that you live, not from the flag of the yacht that you're sailing on. And if you spend most of your time in a particular nation, you may find that your rights actually derive from that nation.
Interesting. Thanks for that. And that's what a lot of people call port states, by the way, guys. This is what he's referring to. And I think with that being said, it is your responsibility as a crew member or wherever you are sitting and standing in the industry, is your responsibility to educate yourself and to really understand what your rights are and not do it when you get into trouble and when something goes wrong. Do it now. Educate yourself. There's many resources out there.
Remember, just because you're a crew member, you're a special breed of person, but sometimes crew members cause themselves problems, often by agreeing to be paid in cash, which often happens. And suddenly they're underneath the radar of the tax authorities. And suddenly they realize that something happens to them and they start complaining. People are going to start looking at you. So what is this person? Where does he live? Has he paid tax? And suddenly, yes, something bad may have happened to them, but they go, actually, I'm going to let it slide.
You're right.
Because I'm going to get into more trouble myself by coming above the radar. And that sometimes happens.
Yeah, absolutely. This whole invading taxes, man, I tell you, there's a lot of people into trouble. Thank you so much for your time. Is there something that you want to say before we wrap it up?
What I do want to say to those people who think people like me, people like you are trying to kill the fun, I'd say this. What we're trying to do is to preserve and perpetuate and elongate the life of this fabulous industry that we all work in. There is a German historian called Jan Ruger, who wrote a brilliant book on the naval arms race between Germany and Great Britain that happened at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. He described yachts as being those seafaring thrones. And with any throne, you need to have the monarch upon those thrones. If we do not change what we do, those kingdoms will be lost. And we will not have those thrones for our industrialists, our entrepreneurs to sit upon. Let's not look at just at the end of our nose. Let's look a bit further than that.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. And this is why I do what I do, because I feel that I am giving back to an industry that gave so much to me as just a crew member. Like, for God's sake, I was just cleaning toilet at the beginning. And it has brought so much joy, so much freedom for me to be able to do so many things for myself, to find myself. It's a beautiful industry. And I think it just needs to be recognized for what it is and not how we have portrayed it to be. I think definitely it is time for transformation. And it starts with us as an individual, like you said, raising your standard. Like, what are your values? Are you actually doing business from that place? Are you coming from fear or are you coming heart-centered? Are you doing to another what you're okay to be done to you? It's a very simple question.
And I can't name the individual yet. But during the lockdown, I was in the West End of London and I bumped into a senior figure in the superyacht industry. And we had a similar conversation to the one that we've just had. And that individual said to me, you know what? This is an easy fix for me to deal with. And he has gone off and he has already set in train some plans, some projects, which will be spectacular when they're announced, because there was that recognition that we can't keep doing the same thing that we've always done and hope for change. We as leaders need to bite the bullet and say, you know what? We've dropped the ball. Look at Lewis Hamilton, for example. The F1 game is replete with wealth and everything that you would think is wrong. But Lewis Hamilton, rather than keep his head down, has driven through the Black Lives Matters message. And as the world champion, has brought that message loud and clear. And I salute Lewis Hamilton for doing that, because it could have been very easy for him just to make a short statement and then carry on with his life. Not only did he get everyone to wear T-shirts, but his team this year, the car is painted black this year in honor of the Black Lives Matters movement, which is an incredible force, rather an incredible statement for Lewis Hamilton to make and to convince his team to do that. And I think there are leaders within our industry who genuinely believe that change is more than overdue. And I think we will see that change, but we've got to keep hammering home that message.
Absolutely. And that's what this is about. Thank you so much for raising your voice, sharing your wisdom with us. I really enjoy having you on the other side. And I know that there's going to be a lot of curiosity sparking right and left for many of us. And the big question here is, are you willing to do what many are not willing to do in order to create this transformation? The choice is yours. Just take action. So thank you again. And I hope that I see you on the show once again later on, because I feel like we have a lot to still discover and explore. And so thank you. And guys, if you have something to share, wisdom to pass on, email me. The email is down below. And just become part of the Uncensored and share your story. And by the way, John, I really hope you write a book if you haven't yet, because I would definitely love to read some of your wisdom and stories and just perspective. So I really hope that's on your to-do list.
It is. It is there.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. All right, guys, that's a wrap. And we'll see you next time.